from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up, we'll hear about this morning's arrest in London of WikiLeaks co-founder Julian Assange. He's been living in the Ecuadorian embassy there since 2012, and this morning, the U.S. charged him with conspiring to hack military computers. British Prime Minister Theresa May applauded the arrest.
This goes to show that in the United Kingdom, no one is above the law.
But first, we talk politics with President Obama's former senior aide, Valerie Jarrett. Her new memoir, Finding My Voice, tracks her transformation from self-doubting corporate lawyer to top White House advisor. That's all next after this news. Welcome to this morning's forum. I'm Michael Krasny. As President Obama's longest-serving senior advisor, Valerie Jarrett led the offices of public engagement and intergovernmental affairs and chaired the White House Council on Women and Girls. But before she entered public service, she was an unfulfilled corporate lawyer in an unhappy marriage. And Valerie Jarrett's new memoir, Finding My Voice, describes how she overcame self-doubt and transformed into an influential policy advisor and advocate for social change. In this segment, we're going to talk with her about her book, her recollections of the Obama White House, and get her thoughts on the Trump administration. And welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be with you.
Pleasure to have you with us here. And I should say just a few things about your book, which I really enjoyed. First of all, I should mention to the listeners that you played a singular role in the Obama White House, longest White House senior advisor, I think, on record. You got the Almanac record there. But this is a couple of books in many ways. It's a book where you talk about having mapped out a happily ever after kind of life, a corporate lawyer, mother, wife, and so forth, and just didn't necessarily go that way. In fact, the marriage toppled and the corporate law changed into a life of public service. I don't want to give away a lot here. This isn't a spoiler. A lot of people know about your life. But what I was also struck by was the title. I mean, you were terribly shy. You were almost in some ways pathologically shy. I mean, and
painfully shy, yes.
Painfully shy, exactly right. And yet you found your voice. You found your voice largely in Harold Washington's administration, feeling you could be a proponent for other people and speak for other people, and thus the title. But I want to get into something even before that. I want to get local with you because Stanford, you applied to Stanford and you had a counselor who said, I don't think you're going to get into Stanford. You applied to 9 schools. You got into all 9. You took those those acceptances and put them on a desk. Horrified your mother. You slammed them down on the desk of the counselor and everything. That's kind of where you found your voice, too, wasn't it?
It was the beginning. But I will tell you, the problem with him telling me that I wouldn't get in is that I went there with a bit of an imposter syndrome. I wondered, did I actually belong? And he did me a real disservice. And I've always kind of wondered, like, why did he do that? Because obviously, if I got in 9 great schools, I had a pretty good chance. And he tried to put a ceiling on my dream. And I did react to it by saying, let me prove him wrong.
You have a long memory. You go back to also standing up for someone else with a bully in Michigan and someone used the N-word on you. And 50 years later, you say in your book, you still remember that. It's still a grievance there. It's there in your viscera.
You know what I remember? Not just that the word was directed at me, but that I didn't respond. I didn't defend myself. And I think for so many people, it's just easier to let it just brush off of you and keep going than to stand up and call people on it. And I wish now I had said something at the time.
Well, your book is also an exploration of being a member of somewhat of the privileged African-American world, what Franklin Frazier would have called the black bourgeoisie. I mean, getting to go to Stanford itself, even meeting people like John Hope Franklin's son. I mean, these are people of what would have been called, I suppose, the African-American aristocracy.
Yeah, well, my great-grandfather, Robert Robertson Taylor, was the first African-American to go to MIT and graduate, first known architect that was African-American in the country. And his father was born a slave and freed during after the Civil War. And so to think about from one generation from slavery to MIT made me always feel that anything is possible, but it also made me feel like, how could I possibly measure up to that?
Well, you also, of course, some people are aware of the fact that you spent your first 5 years in Iran largely because your father found discriminatory practices here in the United States that he wanted to flee from. And you, until 5, you were speaking nothing but Farsi.
Well, Farsi, English, French. We lived on a hospital compound with physicians from all over the world sharing best practices in medicine. And you're right, my dad, who grew up in Washington, D.C., my mom in Chicago during the Jim Crow era, was, he graduated top of his class years early. He skipped a bunch of grades, had great credentials, but yet he couldn't find a job comparable to his white counterparts. And so my parents went off to Iran. And in a sense, that's where he stopped becoming a black doctor and became an American doctor. His confidence grew, and as a result, I was born over the color line. Now, in some ways, it confused me, but in other ways, it gave me a degree of confidence that I think has served me well.
But you also had the advantages to some extent, or some would say maybe disadvantages, of a kind of binary identity. I mean, very light skin.
Yeah, yeah. When we returned to Chicago, my parents plopped me down in the neighborhood public school. It was predominantly black. I was 2 years ahead of myself. I was speaking with a British accent because we lived in London for a year between Iran and Chicago. And, I was fair skin, freckles, red hair. And I used to get beat up all the time. And my younger cousin had to come to my defense, which was embarrassing, but nonetheless helpful. So it was a bit of a culture shock for me. And the irony, of course, is my parents wanted to return home so that I could have a better appreciation for my black identity, which was hard to teach when we lived in Iran. And yet black kids were beating me up. And so that was kind of a reckoning, too.
But you had a fascinating life and certainly an extraordinary career, and you were able to make your mark. Also, finding your voice maybe goes back to the period when you were a corporate lawyer, because you had a friend named Lucille who sort of pushed you to ask for a raise, and you were very timid about that whole thing, but finally did it.
Never occurred to me I should ask for a raise. And she wanted me to ask for a double promotion where I would have my boss would report to me. And I just thought when my boss's boss thought I was prepared that he would give it to me. And she said, well, that's ridiculous. You have to advocate for yourself. And so I'd grown used to advocating for others working in the Harold Washington administration. But she taught me how to advocate for myself.
You also had wonderful parents. It's pretty clear reading your memoir. You were very fortunate.
Amazing. Great parents. They were married for 62 years.
And should we talk about your marriage just for a moment?
Sure.
You were married? Because
yes.
I think there are a lot of women I know who went through similar things. The man's in the man cave. The husband's down there, and he's not accessible, and get very frustrated and very unhappy.
Well, my husband was the boy next door. Our moms grew up in the same apartment building. Our dads were friends. He was a doctor. My dad was a doctor. Our grandmothers were friends. I'd had a crush on him since I was 8 and he was 12. Like, what could possibly go wrong? And everything went wrong. And I kept thinking, I can will this to work. If I just try hard enough, I can make him be the kind of person my father was. And, shame on me for thinking I could change somebody. And he reacted to that by withdrawing. And then I tried harder and he withdrew more. And finally, I realized that it just wasn't working. And I had to accept the fact that just because it didn't work, it didn't make me a failure, but I thought I was. And I had to get over that and realize, look, life goes on. And I had to make my daughter proud of me. And so I left him and I left my job and I started a new life with her in mind.
And I think, as I noted in reading your book, many women can relate to that story. I mean, the whole trajectory of that story and being a single mom and all the rest of it. But at your wedding, you had 7 bridesmaids, and you say, don't ask, in your memoir.
Why on earth did I have 7 bridesmaids? My daughter did it much better. She had no bridesmaids. She had no. I walked her down the aisle with my mom, and his parents walked him down the aisle, and it cut out a lot of complications, although my bridesmaids did amuse me before the wedding started by telling dirty jokes, so they were helpful in that respect. But I have a big family, and I had close friends, and I couldn't choose, so I invited them all.
Never use those two words in a memoir, though, when you're being interviewed by me. Don't ask.
Because then you want to ask anyway. Immediately.
We're talking to Valerie Jarrett, and Valerie Jarrett is the longest serving advisor to any president in U.S. history and also was in both Obama administrations. Had you ever imagined, or had Barack Obama ever imagined, that the successor would be Donald J. Trump?
No, never in my wildest dreams did I think that.
And here we are.
And here we are.
And we have someone who has fancied himself, even from early on and talking about Kenya birth and all of that birther stuff, as the anti-Obama. I mean, don't you see this kind of pattern of opposing everything to some degree that's identified with Barack Obama, even most recently saying he was the one who put kids in cages? He was the one, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's obviously profoundly disappointing and disturbing to me. You talked about the birther movement. He led the birther movement, trying to delegitimize the first African-American president. And I don't know, I think we need leaders who inspire us to find what we have in common, who bring the country together, who you can run a campaign towards your base, but once you're elected, you're the president for the entire country. And I think there's a hunger for that out there. And a lot of what I'm doing now is to try to get people more civically engaged. Elections have very serious consequences, not just who the president is, but who your mayor is, who's on your city council, your state legislature, your county offices. They all impact our lives. And yet, in the last presidential election, 43% of eligible voters did not vote. That I find really troubling, and I'm determined to try to play my part in changing the culture around voting.
How are you going to do that? A lot of apathy out there.
There is a lot of apathy, and Michelle Obama and I started an organization called When We All Vote. It's nonpartisan by design, and it's directed primarily at young people because evidence shows that people who vote in their first election when they're eligible tend to become lifelong voters. And so how can we capture the attention of a generation that is shunning not just government, but all institutions, and they define their community in their device as opposed to geographically the way I grew up in a neighborhood where, you know, you'd go to the grocery store and you knew the people who owned it. And if you got in trouble when you were out, people felt free to discipline you and your parents heard about it before you got home. I mean, that's that sense of community.
Yeah.
I think we are at risk of not having going forward unless we deliberately try to seize it back. But the good news, Michael, from my perspective, as I've traveled outside of Washington and around the country, is I see these ordinary people who are still doing extraordinary things. And what we have to do is lift up their voices. And so when you say, how are you going to get people to vote? Well, partnering with people like the young kids from Florida who are Parkland, Florida, who were devastated by the gun violence in their school, and they had a choice. They could have succumbed to that trauma, or they could have channeled that emotion in a positive direction. And so they spent last summer traveling around the country, red, blue states alike, registering people to vote. And so we're trying to help lift up those stories so that we begin on the ground with a culture change. So this isn't something you can legislate from Washington. This is something where people who you trust and who believe in you will listen when you say, this is why you should vote.
You're talking about grassroots, really, aren't you?
Going back to President Obama's grassroots organizing, it happens. That's how you influence people's hearts, is when people they trust say, this is why you should get involved.
Speaking about influence, you mentioned Michelle Obama. You two had a very close relationship. In fact, I remember reading Maureen Dowd saying, Michelle listens to Valerie Jarrett more than she listens to anybody, even in her own family, or something worse to that effect. I'm obviously paraphrasing. But there was, especially from the right, there was a lot of talk about you having maybe undue influence on the Obamas. What do you say to that?
I consider the Obamas, the younger siblings I never had, were very close, and I don't apologize for that one bit. I know them well. I know what their core values are. I know what his vision for our country was, and I was just privileged to be able to be there every step of the way, helping him in any way that I could. And I think my experience in local government and running a private business, real estate business, serving on corporate boards, having leadership roles in Chicago, kept me grounded in a way that he found helpful in the White House. And Michelle Robinson, I met 28 years ago, and to see her grow into this incredible force of nature that she is today. What I'd say about both of them is it's not that they've changed. It's really that the country's had a chance to see revealed what I recognized so many years ago.
There was even something I was reading recently about you confronting President Obama about machismo in the White House.
Well, you know what? You could remember, and I'm sure many of your listeners do, when President Obama took office, we were in the middle of the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. We had two wars going on. We had a health care crisis going on with people not being able to have adequate health insurance. We had a confidence crisis in terms of how the United States was perceived around the world. We had a lot going on, and there was a lot of testosterone flowing. And what I knew about President Obama is that he wanted a culture in the White House where every voice mattered. And since I had started out having a quiet voice, I recognized in some of my colleagues that they were shying away and that their voices weren't being heard and listened to. And he changed that. He said, look, I am determined to make informed decisions informed by each of you who I handpicked to be here. And if you're not speaking up, then I'm not going to make as good of a decision. That was incredibly empowering. And I think everybody comes to a job with the baggage from their last job. And I think for some of my colleagues in the White House, they did not appreciate the kind of culture he wanted to create. And it's kind of a leadership lesson to those who are listening that culture doesn't happen just because you want it to. You have to be very deliberate about it. And he did step in and change the culture. And as a result, he heard more voices, more ideas, more different perspectives, and I think made better decisions.
And now you have a president who says, I can fix it all. I don't have to listen to anybody. Just wondering, though, I mean, like I said, there's quite the antithesis there. You mentioned health care, and there are those who feel that the Obama administration put maybe too much emphasis on health care. On the other hand, the argument goes that they at least stepped up and did something as opposed to this administration or the Republicans who have not come up with any health care plan. At the same time, do you think that all that emphasis on health care may have in some ways weakened or diminished what else could have been done, i.e. particularly immigration, which now is being criticized?
Well, it's interesting. I hear that a lot, but the way President Obama organized his White House is he had policy councils and different people responsible for different policies. And so the people who are working on health care were not the same people working on immigration. So we could multitask. We could do many things at the same time by how we organize the White House. So the fact of the matter is we pushed everything towards Congress for legislative solutions because we know those are the most sustainable. And we were able to get through what could get done. For example, don't ask, don't tell, which was preventing gay people from openly serving in the military, passed the same day that the DREAM Act failed. And so those were two matters that we cared very much about that we pushed, and one went forward and one didn't. And that's on Congress, frankly. And we are profoundly disappointed that we couldn't get comprehensive immigration reform done. And the steps that President Obama did take were by executive action. And we all know that, you know, those are reversible by the next president. And that's on the responsibility rests with Congress for not having passed it.
Our guest is Valerie Jarrett, and her new book is called Finding My Voice, My Journey to the West Wing and the Path Forward. And she'll be speaking at the Commonwealth Club today at noon and at Dominican University tonight at 7. And if you'd like to join us, I want to invite you to do that. If you have questions for her or if you'd like to simply weigh in here, our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786, and you can join us now. Again, toll-free 866-733-6786. You can also join us by emailing us forum@kqed.org or going to our website and posting any questions or comments you have there at kqed.org/forum and click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. So you've got a big field now of Democratic candidates, and I have to ask you, I don't necessarily want to ask you who you favor or anything along those lines, but President Obama recently was saying there's going to be maybe too much political progressive stuff that's going to be over on the extremes here and maybe going to have people shooting each other and hurting each other. And then when we get down to who's going to be selected, there's going to be too much damage done. We're seeing that now to some extent, some would say, with Joseph Biden. He hasn't even entered the race yet, and they're bringing up the Iraq War. They're bringing up Anita Hill. I mean, they being his opponents, too. So your thoughts on that?
I'd say a few things to you. First of all, I think we have an embarrassment of riches in the Democratic field. So that's a good thing. There are credible, inspirational, qualified people who have already put their name in the hat, and I respect anyone who wants to get in the arena, particularly in this rather toxic environment. So that's point number one. Point number two, I would say, is that I think what resonates with voters is an authentic person who speaks exactly to what their vision for our country is and why we should trust that they're qualified to implement that vision. I also think that we run the risk of going into the general election in a weakened state if we are so busy criticizing one another as opposed to keeping our eye on the ball, which is really the general election. And the final point is that it's one thing to have great, bold ideas while you're campaigning, and I think that's terrific. But there's a difference between campaigning and governing. And in governance, in a big, complicated democracy such as ours with a range of perspectives, you have to be willing to not let perfect be the enemy of the good. And I mean, a good example would be something like the public option. I personally think that's a great solution to our healthcare problem. In a sense, Medicare for all. Medicare system works very, very well, and people are pleased with it. In fact, some people say, keep government out of my Medicare, not recognizing it's a government program. But we were unable to get the votes for Medicare for all, for a public option. And so instead we did the ACA. And you know what? Today, 20 million people have health care who wouldn't have had it. People with pre-existing conditions, 1 in 2 Americans couldn't be discriminated against. Women can get preventive care. Kids can stay on their parents' plan until they're 26, et cetera. And so I say this by example to say that once you're there, you have to be willing to say, all right, yes, I'm not going to compromise my values, but I am going to try to get something done. And I think that was a part of President Obama's caution, having gone from a campaign to governing.
He was also talking about candidates, though, shooting each other too much and going after each other too much.
To the detriment of the general election.
Exactly right, yeah. And that is a danger for the Democrats, isn't it?
It is absolutely a danger. We should be mindful of that. And also recognizing that instead of criticizing one another, tell us what you're going to do. That should take up enough oxygen. Just what are you going to do and why are you qualified?
Let me bring a caller aboard here, and that's you, Jacqueline. You're on the air. Good morning. Welcome.
Hey, welcome. Thanks for taking my call. And congratulations, Valerie. My name is Jacqueline. I live in San Rafael. I'm a spiritual director and an alcohol and drug counselor and admirer of you and the Obamas. And just a question about racism. For me, as a spiritual director, I really see that the Trump election and administration is a direct, fearful reaction from our country against African-Americans, Black people. And just sort of wondering if you see it that way, and if so, how can we address it in a compassionate, action-filled way? Thanks for taking my call.
What a thoughtful question. Thank you, Jacqueline. I don't exactly see it that way. And I spent a lot of time after the election trying to figure out what in the world happened there. And I think where I come down is when 43% of eligible voters don't vote, you can't read too much into the intent of the country as a whole. And the question I ask is, well, why can't we engage them? Why can't we lift up the positive voices who want to have a president who believes we should pull ourselves together and not try to polarize us as we have seen happening over the last couple of years? The answer to your question, I think, is it happens on the ground. It happens with people like you in your community pulling out the better angels in us all and lifting up the voices of people who want to move beyond our horrible history of racism and discrimination and see a better day ahead. And empowering those voices is a piece of what I want to do. And it sounds like from your job description, you do that every day.
It sounds like also in many people's minds, white supremacists and those who are racist have been empowered by this president. That's the argument you hear.
Well, that is, I think, a very valid point is that they're not being muffled the way they were before, and they're coming welcomingly out into the open, and that is a dangerous sign for our country.
Going to continue with Valerie Garrett, hearing her now strong voice, and again, we'll go to your calls when we return. She is former senior advisor to President Barack Obama, author of Finding My Voice. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Quick broadcaster mistake noted. I said Garrett instead of Jarrett. It's Valerie Jarrett who's here with us in studio, and I know that name. I even know her maiden name is Bowman. And do you feel sometimes more like a Bowman than a Jarrett?
Yeah, I guess I do.
Okay.
Both. I am now both.
Your daughter got married how long ago?
My daughter got married in 2012.
And so she had to change her name?
She kept Jarrett. Her? Yes, yeah. She did.
That's what I thought. We're going to go to more of your calls here. I just want to ask you quickly, though, something that has come up over and over again with the Obama administration that is seen as a major mistake, and that is when he talked about a red line with Syria. Now, it was clear that the administration wanted to politically see to it that Bashar al-Assad would perhaps be replaced politically. That did, now he's still in power, and the criticism goes something like this. Obama was talking a big game, but he never followed through. He wasn't macho enough, in fact, so the argument goes. What do you say to that?
Look, he thought that if he drew that line and he sent the message that it would be a way of deterring Assad from using horrendous measures to kill his own people. And he also thought that to do that, he needed to have a coalition. It couldn't be just the United States alone. And after Great Britain pulled out and said they weren't prepared to go forward and put troops on the ground, President Obama had to weigh, which he always did before he put Americans in harm's way, whether it made sense for us to go on the ground and try to intervene and get into another war. And he decided he couldn't. And so, yes, in a sense, he tried to put the pressure where he could politically with the threat. But then once he lost the coalition, he decided it was in our best interest not to move forward.
But you would agree that it made him seem weak in many people's judgment?
Yeah, but you know what? To me, weakness is when you do something you feel bullied into doing as opposed to what you think at the time is right, even if it means reversing what you said before. And so I think before he put people in our country on the ground, he had to do a double, you know, check, and he decided not to go forward.
We'll bring another caller aboard here, and that's you, Judy. Welcome. You're on the air.
Thank you. I have two quick things. One, Valerie, I want to thank you so much, and the administration that you represent, for everything that you did. And secondly, I really would like to know, how do you and how do the Obamas cope with what is going on in this administration? I know how hard it is for me and my family and friends, and I've been wondering how in the world are all of you coping?
Well, first of all, thank you for your kind words. I really appreciate that. It was an honor to serve. And I think people often ask me that question. And for me, the trauma isn't about us. We went there. We did our best. We expected to work 24/7, and it was a privilege to do so. So my concern isn't for us, but it's for the people whose lives are being impacted by these decisions, some of which we are seeing quite visibly, the separation of families at the border, for example, children who may never be reunited with their parents because of the sloppy way, inhumane way in which it was done, or what doesn't get enough attention. When we walked away from the climate deal, not only did we walk away, but then we now have a Department of Environmental Protection that is rolling back all of the different executive orders and regulations that we put in place to protect our environment and keep our climate in a place where next generations will be able to breathe and thrive. And so, and then the constant threat of repealing the Affordable Care Act. There are families around our country right now who are scared to death, who have pre-existing conditions, who have children with pre-existing conditions, who are wondering, well, if you take it away, what will I have? And so it is really with those families that that I just feel an enormous amount of pain for what they're having to go through, and really concerned about how do we get people to appreciate that elections do have consequences. And the response can't be just to be paralyzed. It has to be to mobilize and take action. But thank you. Thank you for your very kind words.
Thank you, Judy, for the call. How much do you believe, or how much do the Obamas believe for that matter? Not necessarily you can speak for them on this, but I'd be interested to hear your thoughts, that racism had a good deal to do with the shift to Trump. And I mean, it was before Charlottesville and all of that, but there was a feeling among many American citizens that perhaps things had become too black. You know, you had Eric Holder working for as attorney general and doing a lot of things on behalf of black people. You had a sense of maybe a kind of partiality against white people for those people who were disposed to think that way that was galvanized. Is that a fair assessment?
No, I don't think so. I would not attribute it to racism, because that's the same country that elected Barack Obama twice. And so, you know, you might say if it was a fluke if it happened once, but when it happens twice, I think no. But I do think there was a fueling of the sense that the zero-sum game, that if we were trying to put policies in place that gave every child a fair shot, that somehow that was taking something away from another child. And that was never either our intent or our policies. They were designed to enlarge in the pie, not take pie from one person and give it to another. But in this media environment where a lot of misinformation swirls without accountability, it's easy to kind of fall into that campaign of thinking, well, who's looking out for me? Well, Barack Obama was looking out for everyone.
Do you think there's a lot of fake news, as our president now continues to say over and over again?
I think it gets a lot harder to figure out the difference between fact and fiction when we self-select, when we have a device in the palm of our hand where we get the information we want from the sources that we want. And when you and I were growing up, it was Walter Cronkite, right? What he said was true, and he didn't blur the lines between news and information and editorial and entertainment. And it gets harder today. And you have enterprises like Fox News, which have an editorial position which bleeds into the news. And I think that makes it – that's one example that makes it more challenging.
There are those who say Fox News is simply an operation that supports and completely is dictated to by the Trump administration. Agree with that?
Well, actually, Fox News has been doing what it has been doing long before this administration came into place. And I think it and social media all contribute to make it very difficult to get out an affirmative message. But that's the challenge. You have to figure out how to break through. And Barack Obama did it twice, and he won elections. And I think you can't read too much into the last election. I think you have to just still go out and believe that people are basically good and love our country and want to make it better. And I think that's a message that still wins the day.
Again, our guest is Valerie Jarrett. Her book is Finding My Voice, My Journey to the West Wing and the Path Forward. Quick question from Mike, who wants to know from you. What advice did you give President Obama about getting his ideas implemented by Congress and dealing with the hard-headed John Boehner and Mitch McConnell?
This is an area where I will confess to your audience, I was naive. I come from Chicago. It's pretty rough and tumble politics there. So I thought I was prepared. What I would note in contrast, and President Obama, who served in the Springfield legislature as a junior senator, was able to work very effectively across the aisle. But Washington had a different fever that we were unable to break. And that you mentioned the two leaders, Speaker Boehner and Leader McConnell, both who basically made up their mind in the very beginning that their strategy was just to say no. And we believed that we had to be caught trying, and because you can't govern by only talking to your base. And their strategy was to say no. And that's a pretty diabolical strategy when they should be looking out for the country. They were looking out for themselves.
We've been talking with Valerie Jarrett, former senior advisor to President Barack Obama. Her new memoir, again, is Finding My Voice, My Journey to the West Wing and the Path Forward. Thank you, Valerie Jarrett.
My pleasure. Thank you to your listening audience.
And stay with us.